Welcome back to the Roundtable, investigating numerical misinformation. Daniel Levitin shows how mishandled statistics and graphs can give a grossly distorted perspective and lead us to terrible decisions. Wordy arguments, on the other hand, can easily be persuasive as they drift away from the facts in an appealing yet misguided way. Ultimately, Levitin turns to what underlies our ability to determine if something is true or false, the scientific method. He grapples with the limits of what we can and cannot know. Case studies are offered to demonstrate the applications of logical thinking to quite varied settings, spanning courtroom testimony, medical decision-making, magic, modern physics, and conspiracy theories. Levitin is the James McGill Professor Emeritus of Psychology and Music at McGill University in Montreal, where he also heads appointments in the program in behavioral neuroscience. His new book is Weaponized Lies: How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Levitin to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Well, it's very nice to have you back in the program. You know, we had you on when this book was first out in hardcover, and I will, I think you will admit this, I certainly will admit this, this seemed to be a very different book a year ago.
It seemed like a fusty old anachronism, a call for the kind of critical thinking that might have been taught in prep schools 25 years ago. But who could have anticipated the 3 months we had in the fall where lies and half-truths and distortions started to spin out of control, and a lack of evidence-based thinking became the norm?
So how do you define the post-truth era? Where are we right now?
Well, you know, I object to the post-truth era on a number of grounds. I mean, I think the way I would define it is that we're in an age when a lot of people are trying to make sense of the world and make sense of what they want and how we want to move forward politically and socially, economically. And people are fed up, I think, with, the attempts of intellectuals to reason their way through the muddled problems, and they want to go by their guts. And guts have a very poor history of being the way to make good decisions, but people are desperate. And so I think the post-truth era is an attempt to emancipate ourselves from the shackles of reason and try something else.
So what is wrong with reason?
Well, I think there's nothing wrong with reason. I think that reason, the age of reason, also called the Enlightenment, ushered in a kind of golden age of progress, automation in factories. The age of reason brought us the germ theory of disease and penicillin, and it's made a dent in solving poverty, and it's made a dent in trying to provide equal rights to women and to reduce racism. We have a long way to go, of course, but I think that if people are left to their gut, they're invoking a neural system in the brain that evolved to deal with the world the way it was 20,000 years ago and can't deal with the complexities of the world the way it is today.
The book makes the point that we are just bombarded with so much information every single day that our brains are trying to make sense of all of this. And as you said, especially during the recent election season, you have all of this information. Some of it's true, some of it's not. You got a lot of numbers, you got a lot of data, and you try to make sense of it. And I guess the question I have is, what is the starting point, and how much should we, because if you start questioning everything, you're just never going to live your life, right?
Right.
So how do you do the triage of thinking, of saying, okay, this is worth my time to look into and to get to the truth, and how to think that I want to think critically about this and let other things go by the wayside?
Well, I think it's a combination of common sense and education, educating ourselves about what steps we can take to think for ourselves about the veracity of things. So, I mean, in terms of the triage, the three steps that come to mind right away are ask yourself whether you're reading a reliable source, whether the account is backed up by evidence. If somebody just makes a claim and they don't offer evidence, usually a reporter, a trained investigative reporter, if the story is worthwhile, will get involved and tell you whether there's evidence or not. And another thing is ask yourself whether it's plausible. Does it make any sense that this could be? A taxi driver said to me the other day that 17 billion people in the world lacked internet, he had heard. Well, you know, there's only about 7.5 billion people in the world, more or less. So that's not a plausible claim. Now, you know, you can argue about whether more people should have internet or not, but, you know, when you're talking about diseases or roads or, you know, things to which we attach numbers and make public policy decisions, the numbers matter. And the third thing we can do, apart from seeking reliable sources with evidence, checking plausibility, is we can insist that we're listening to real experts and not pseudo-experts. And this is a big deal because people go into the media all the time and talk about stuff they don't know anything about. And, you know, you and me need to partner in this, you know, and journalists and scientists more generally,
right,
and not let somebody like William Shockley, who won a Nobel Prize in physicist, start spouting deeply racist views. You know, and he knows nothing about genetics or, you know, any of the things he was talking about.
So I'm curious, you know, if you're in a coffee shop and you're standing in line and somebody walks up to you and says, and you're just having a casual conversation and they say, you know, I can't believe, I believe that President Trump, that the Trump Tower was wiretapped and by President Obama. And you would say, oh, okay. And you wouldn't take that. Maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't. But for the most part, you just say, oh, it's the guy I met at the coffee shop. When the president, and this is what you were saying about the import of a reliable source. So when the president of the United States then accuses another president of the United States of doing this, I think we're all left wondering, well, okay, we have never been in a position, or not to my memory anyway, a position where a statement was made like that, a very serious allegation, a felony, and we have no facts. So we look for who are the reliable sources? Who are the people? Now, we have plenty of people saying, well, that didn't happen, but we don't have any other logic to look at it and say, well, that did happen. And I think that has just a lot of us figuring out, well, okay, but what is even the motive of doing that? And how did we come to this in the first place? I don't mean to make this an overtly political conversation, but I am using it as an example of how we're trying to figure this stuff out and trying to get to the bottom of these, well, lies.
Well, I agree with you. This is not a political issue. This is a democratic issue. Trying to make evidence-based decisions, holding public officials and public policymakers accountable to evidence, I think is not something that falls along lines of Democrat or Republican or Libertarian. It's how a democracy is supposed to work. Now, to take the case of go back to your triage question and tie it into your question about the guy in the coffee shop who thinks that Trump's phones were wiretapped, I'd say part of the triage is that we have to figure that we're going to worry about the big things and not worry about the little things. If Trump's phones were tapped, I think that's a big thing we should worry about. Whether he had a larger audience in attendance at his inauguration, the National Park Service, as you know, and probably reported on, just released a trove of photographs today with aerial and other shots of the Trump and Obama inaugurations. But to me, who cares? You know, there are more important things for us to worry about than that. So in the hierarchy of things that I need to pay attention to, that's pretty low on the list of priorities. But getting back to the phone tapping, I think that the 24-hour news cycle and the internet have created kind of a rush to be first with the news that I think is to the detriment of careful and systematic reporting. Now, the government, broadly writ, has certainly lied to us or misled us. They misled us about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We did have a president, Richard Nixon, who lied when he said he was not a crook. It turns out he was a crook. We had Bill Clinton lying on the stand about his relations with an intern. So I think in those cases, in the case of Nixon and the case of Clinton, and in this case, we should let the system do its job. We should let reporters do their digging. We should let investigators do their investigating. And we may not know the answer to this for a while. Now, that might be part of the strategy of a Trump administration to set us off balance or to distract us, or it might be that they really believe this and they're being transparent and honest with us that this is a concern that they're looking into. But either way, I think, we can develop an emotional reaction to it, but that's not the same as a reasoned and evidence-based one. And in this case, I think we have to wait.
So my question, to bring it just a little bit deeper, though, is when you have these quote-unquote reliable sources, I'm not saying that we would always trust those in government, those who are our leaders, that we don't, it's not just a blind trust. But given what is happening and has been happening over the past year, year and a half, doesn't it make your call all the more difficult when there is a validation of boldly just wrong things that are being stated, lies, that are being fake news, whatever you want to call it, alternative facts that are being posited, and so doesn't it make your call all the more difficult because there even seems to be a point where just the way we are hardwired is to say, oh, well, there has to be something to this or the claim wouldn't have been made. And even though 75 people say, no, this never did happen, you still have that shadow of a doubt.
Well, and that shadow of a doubt is healthy skepticism, but we can't run with a shadow and we can't run with speculation. I don't think it makes my call harder. I think it makes it easier.
Really? How so?
I think the issue here is that we've come to a point where we have to think for ourselves and apply a little bit of common sense. And as the tribunal of the committee of three federal judges who ruled on the immigration ban said, there is no evidence that these seven nations pose a threat. And this is a refrain we're hearing from the judiciary and from various watchdogs. It's the way the system's supposed to work. We're hearing, in response to the president's claims, there is no evidence. Now, if the president had said, I have evidence that my phones were tapped by the Obama administration, I can't reveal it because it's classified, that would be slightly better than what we've got. At least he'd be playing by the rules of commonly accepted rational thought. But to just say something without evidence, I think, pushes us towards a complacency of accepting a post-truth or post-evidentiary era. And I think that threatens to set us back 400 years. I'm not trying to be dramatic here, and I'm not trying to be political. I think we need to insist, all of us, the media, public citizens, we need to insist that when a claim is made, there's evidence to back it up. And I'm glad to see that journalists are doubling down on their efforts rather than backing down, as Sean Spicer initially urged them to do. Many journalists are doubling down. And I don't know if you've been following what's happened in the New York Times, but they did a lot of soul searching about the miscall of the election,
right,
and the misreading of the American voters. And in the last couple of weeks, their op-eds have been a lot broader in their reach as a way to redress some shortcomings. We've seen a pro-Bannon op-ed, a pro-life op-ed on the opinion pages. And I think in general, journalists are working harder to serve the needs of the public and to fact check and to remind us why facts are important.
Daniel Levitin is the author of Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. So I'm a bit confused because I understand what you're saying, but I still think that if there is a normalization to that, and we have this barrage on a federal level, that it starts to seep into our communities and our homes and our schools and our churches, that it is, as you say, can set us back 400 years. So that goes back to my original point of, that seems to me to make it all the more harder to think critically, because we have more of it to think critically about.
We certainly do, and I think that I think part of it is a team effort. We have to rely on, well, the judicial branch and on the independent press. We have to rely on scientists to address facts or inaccuracies having to do with scientific claims or medical claims. And then, again, each of us has to, yeah, it takes a little bit of time to think critically, but not as much as you would imagine. But I think it falls to each of us to become informed citizens. And that's why I wrote the book. I wrote The Field Guide to Lies, which is being reissued today as Weaponized Lies. I wrote it because I wanted to arm everybody with the tools that they needed and could apply very quickly in their own lives to avoid being taken advantage of. It's not just about the White House and trying to figure out what's going on in public policy, but it's about making informed decisions about your medical care, about deciding who to trust with your precious retirement fund so that you don't end up with a situation where somebody made off with your money.
Yeah.
See what I did there?
Very nice.
And I think that, you know, as an educator, I feel that we've failed an entire generation of students by not training them to think this way automatically, as a knee-jerk reaction to a claim, to know what kind of questions to ask, to follow up. And, you know, students who read this book, I think, will do better in school. Let me give you an example, just to make this concrete.
Yep.
Have you heard the claim, Joe, that 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Colgate?
I have heard that.
Well, so it turns out Colgate got sued and lost. Why? Well, a couple of reasons. One is the claim implies, it doesn't state it, but it implies that these dentists prefer Colgate. And so when you hear a claim like this, one thing you might ask is, what were the dentists asked? What was the question that the surveyors asked the dentists? It turns out they were asked to list all the toothpastes that they think would be helpful. And yes, 4 out of 5 recommended Colgate, but they recommended Crest and Gleam and Aquafresh and AIM and a whole bunch of other toothpastes. So the claim is misleading. It's misleading on a deeper level, though, which gets back to my earlier point, Joe, about pseudo-experts. I don't think the dentists are the right people to weigh in on this. I've been going to a dentist my whole life, and my dentist has never asked me what toothpaste I use.
Right.
Has yours asked you?
No.
Right. I mean, they're not really keeping track. So what you need there, and, you know, this is critical thinking, is you need a medical researcher who has randomly assigned toothpaste to different people, follow them for a few years, and seen what the oral health outcomes were. Who's got gum disease? Who's got cavities? That's a proper scientific study. Without it, you're just asking somebody an opinion that, you know, shame on those dentists for answering the survey. They don't know, and they know they don't know.
So the question is, and I wrote this down in the margin of the book while I was reading it. Okay, I didn't write it down in the margin of the book because I don't do that, but I did write a note on it, which is...
you're hewing very carefully to the facts here.
Very much so.
Because somebody could get your book and call
right,
you
well,
on it.
People who know me know that I can't hurt a book. But you become cynical. I mean, when I say 4 out of 5, when I see it on TV, the 4 out of 5 dentists, I dismiss it right away. I'm like, okay, well, they're trying to sell me something, and it's a statistic, and I'll buy the toothpaste that I like, that I that works for me. Okay, fine. But that idea of being cynical, and you're right about this. I'm curious about, because we will often say it is a bad thing. You know, you cynically reject this, you cynically reject that. But there is such a thing as a healthy skepticism slash cynicism over certain things, especially now, isn't there?
I don't advocate that we cynically reject everything, but I don't want us. I also want us to avoid the extreme of gullibly accepting everything.
Right.
And I think, you know, we have to find the balance. I mean, a simple thing I would say, there's some simple things here. One is, if you read a poll, a public opinion poll, and they don't report the margin of error, I would ignore it. The numbers are meaningless without the margin. I could tell you that I've got blue hair with a margin of error of 100%, and that makes it true. And if I don't tell you the margin of error, you don't know.
Yeah.
Another thing is, you know, with claims about medication, some of the more forward-thinking ad agencies and pharmaceutical companies will, in the fine print on the TV ad or the voiceover on the radio ad, will tell you there was a study done about this, and you can look it up. Or you can go yourself to Google Scholar, not regular old Google, but scholar.google.com, which limits the results to the peer-reviewed literature, scientific and medical literature, and put in the name of the drug and see what there is on it.
The idea that I'm curious. I realized we have, only have about a minute and a half here, so I want to ask my final question, which is the new book, as you say, this is The Field Guide to Lies, was the original book, and now it's been rebranded as Weaponized Lies. That's a really loaded term, isn't it?
Yes. I'm beginning to feel, though, that evidence-based thinking is more urgent than I thought it was a year ago when I handed in the manuscript for the book, because we've got this guy who drove up to suburban D.C. and shot up a pizza place because he thought Hillary Clinton was running a child sex slave operation out of it. That's a lie that became weaponized. It's a lie that was forwarded on Facebook a million times, and the Snopes, revealing that it was a lie, only got 35,000 hits. So we've got a real asymmetry there between the lie and the truth. And I would say, before you put the thumbs up on Facebook or forward a social media post, just ask yourself if it's plausible, if it's well-sourced, and don't contribute to the problem.
Oh, great idea. The name of the book is Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. The book is now out in paperback. Daniel Levitin, thank you very much for being with us. I know you teach at McGill, but are you a U.S. citizen or a Canadian citizen?
I'm both. I was born and raised in the U.S. I'm also a proud U.S. and proud Canadian citizen.
Are you spending more time in Canada now?
I'm spending about the same amount, and I'm now teaching at the UC Berkeley School of Business. I'm teaching courses in critical thinking to business executives.
All right. Well, that's good work, too. Daniel, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Weaponized Lies. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.